listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to this show than on more stations and outlets than any other progressive show in the world. Talk show, radio talk show. There might be some progressive TV shows out there. I don't know. Anyhow, the Charles B. P. Pierce is taking on Bill Kristol. Let me give you a little background here. First of all, Rand Paul has decided to throw his father overboard. Ron Paul came out on the issue of Russia, the Ukraine, and the U.S. Ron Paul came out and said, you know, why do we care about the Ukraine? Or why do we care about Crimea? It's got nothing to do with us. It's not in our security interest. The closest thing we've got is you know, Chevron cut an oil deal with them. What's the big deal here? But Rand Paul, who's running for president, has decided, you know, if you're running for president, you got to wave the flag around and call for a big military and that kind of thing. So he says, and I quote, "The United States should make it abundantly clear to Russia that we expect them to honor the December 1944 Budapest Memorandum, in which the U.S., Russia, and the United Kingdom reaffirmed their commitment to respect the independence and sovereignty of the existing borders of Ukraine." Now, as the American Thinker points out, and this is over at the economicpolicyjournal.com, as the American Thinker points out, interesting that both sides have apparently violated the agreement already, which in diplomacy usually means the agreement's no longer in effect. And they go on to add, the U.S. has obviously been meddling in the affairs of Ukraine, and it's simply outrageous to think that we should play any role in the affairs of Ukraine. Ukraine is 5,000 miles away from the U.S., no military threat or any other threat to the U.S., and it sits on the border of Russia. For absolutely no good reason, the U.S. is provoking the Russian bear. So that's the backstory. And then Bill Kristol came along and wrote this in the Weekly Standard. He says, "So will Obama now move beyond affirmations to actions? Will Obama expedite the admission of Georgia to NATO and begin to move toward a security relationship with Ukraine?" Now, can you imagine? I mean, you know, how we would respond if Russia cut a deal with Cuba and say started putting missiles there? Oh yeah, that's right. We already did respond to that. Anyhow, back to Bill Kristol. "Will Obama canvass his administration to discover the many other things that could be done to begin to undermine Putin at home and abroad?" So Charles, you know, this is Bill Kristol, the happy neocon, the guy who talked us into Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, he's just always happy to shed somebody else's blood with a big smile. And they love to put him on television because he smiles so nicely. So Charles P. Pierce, gives a response over in Esquire magazine and their blogs at Esquire.com, gives a response to Bill Kristol. He says, "You monstrous, bloodthirsty fraud, you stupid, silly, chicken hawk mother who plays army man with the children of people who are so much better than you and who would feed innocent civilian in lands you will never visit into your own personal meat grinder to service your semi-annual martial erection. You and the rest of your cowardly cohort helped prepare the ground for the worst geopolitical mistake this country has made in 30 years. You fought the battle of the green rooms and the think tanks while other people's sons and daughters died for your fantasy of how the world would work if you really were the pimply adolescent Zeus you see when you look in the mirror every morning. The country does not need your lectures anymore, Bill Kristol. The country does not need your counsel. The country does not need your advice. And as sure as human beings have become dead because of your lectures, Bill Kristol, your counsel and advice, human beings about whom you otherwise care nothing, the country does not need your hectoring that it has become insufficiently bellicose to fulfill your newest blood-drenched fantasies. Even here, or even now, you hide behind the skirts of a woman from Indiana who, while I believe her to be wrong, seems to be genuine in her beliefs. You are unworthy of her intellectual camouflage. You should be driven from polite society, consigned to an ideological Molokai so that you can no longer infect the rest of us. People should shun you. You should wear the bell for the rest of your miserable days. Amen. Jim, do you have George rendered? Let me play you. This is George Galloway, who's been a guest on this program a number of times, a Scottish member of the British Parliament, speaking before the United States Congress about the last war that Bill Kristol helped talk us into. He's speaking to members of Congress who voted to invade Iraq.
And I told the world that your case for the war was a pack of lies. I told the world that Iraq, contrary to your claims, did not have weapons of mass destruction. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to Al-Qaeda. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that Iraq had no connection to the atrocity on 9/11/2001. I told the world, contrary to your claims, that the Iraqi people would resist a British and American invasion of their country, and that the fall of Baghdad would not be the beginning of the end, but merely the end of the beginning. Senator, in everything I said about Iraq, I turned out to be right, and you turned out to be wrong. And 100,000 people have paid with their lives, 1,600 of them American soldiers, sent to their deaths on a pack of lies, 15,000 of them wounded, many of them disabled forever, on a pack of lies. If the world had listened to Kofi Annan, whose dismissal you demanded, if the world had listened to President Chirac, who you want to paint as some kind of corrupt traitor, if the world had listened to me and the anti-war movement in Britain, we would not be in the disaster that we're in today.
George Galloway, British Member of Parliament. He may be a former Member of Parliament. I'm not sure if he ran for re-election last time around. But he's been on this program a number of times, back in the day, back in 2003, 4, 5, 6. Charles Pierce headlined his little speech to Bill Kristol. Just in from our sociopath bureau. Just shut up and go away. All right. It's just astounding to me. So we've got that on the international front. Then on the domestic front, Ralph Reed. This is on MSNBC's Morning Joe, right? MSNBC, the network owned by Comcast, a very, very conservative family owns Comcast. You will never hear a conversation on MSNBC about net neutrality because Comcast is trying to undo that, and actually has, succeeded. You will never hear a conversation about media consolidation because they're consolidating media. You will never hear a conversation about the real issues that are tearing apart this country, tragically. Ralph Reed, sitting here with Mika Brzezinski, basically says, rather than giving women food stamps, why don't we just make divorce harder so their husbands have to stick around and give them money? Why should we pay for the food stamps for divorced women, for single mothers? Yeah, it's a nice talking point for the billionaire class, the Rand Paul class, the hereditary aristocracy class, the oligarch class.
He says, I personally think the no-fault divorce revolution in the 60s and 70s has not been good for society.
At what point are we going to start to say to people like Ralph Reed and Bill Kristol and Rand Paul and these other buffoons and George W. Bush and Condi Rice and Dick Cheney, you guys are war criminals, you are wrong, you are sick.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you are harming this country, you are distorting this country, you are destroying this country. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour, and if I can make my mouse move, there we go. Andrew Campbell, producer with The Big Picture, senior producer of The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom.
So, Abby Huntsman wants to privatize Social Security or reduce the or raise the retirement age to 75 or cut the benefits by 20% or some crazy-ass thing. What is this?
Yeah, she gave a rant the other day on the MSNBC's The Cycle, which she is a co-host on, and basically spewed out a bunch of right-wing talking points about Social Security. And
these are not just talking points, Andrew. These are lies.
Well, a lot of Republican talking points are outright lies, too.
Yeah.
But it raises the question of, I mean, these were blatant lies that she said on the program. Shouldn't she at the very least issue some sort of correction? I mean, there was nothing factual at all to what she had to say about Social Security.
Yeah. Well, you know, MSNBC puts right wingers on and doesn't tend to contradict them. I mean, look at Morning Joe. You get hours of it every morning. It's one of the most watched programs in America, at least on cable. I mean, it's just, wow. Anyhow, okay, so we're going to correct Abby Huntsman, basically. And then from there, we're going to go into the Lone Liberal Rumble.
Yep, we're going to have on Kevin Martin and Horace Cooper. We're going to talk about, as you were just talking about, Bill Kristol and his recent comments about sending U.S. troops into the Ukraine, and talk back to that a little bit. We'll also be talking about Wyoming rejecting new national science education standards because they think that climate change isn't real. So we'll be touching on that, and we'll also be...
Yeah. Both senators from Wyoming. Isn't that Inhofe and Coburn, aren't they from Wyoming?
Yes.
Yeah. So both senators from Wyoming either have their heads up their backsides or are totally in the bag for the oil industry. And given, you know, that Cheney lives there, Halliburton came out of there, Wyoming and Texas, and that it's a big fracking state, I would say that these guys, they have to know what's going on. They're paid off shills. These people are political criminals.
Even Texas has passed these new standards, albeit there was some controversy, but they passed them through. We'll also be touching on what a basic income for all Americans would mean and how we could go about implementing that. And we'll talk about the GOP's autopsy report. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of it. And it doesn't seem like much has changed despite what Republicans wanted to do a year ago, so we'll get into that.
Well, I think they wanted to talk nice. Maybe they had a moment of clarity, but, you know, basically what it would have said was stop being shills for the 1% and stop, you know, calling in the racists and the bigots to be part of your party because that's what you need to win elections. And I think the Republicans looked around and said, you know, we need to win elections. We need the racists and bigots.
So,
anyhow, and then we're going to have conversations with great minds.
Yeah, we're going to have a special conversations with great minds with Shane Bauer, Sarah Short, and Josh Vital. People might remember that Sarah Short and Josh Vital were the Americans that were kidnapped as they were hiking in or near Iran back in 2009, and they were held there for 3 years. And they're going to be on to talk about their experiences in a Tehran prison, as well as the prison system in the U.S. and how that can be reformed.
Yeah, these guys have become major spokespeople for reforming the U.S. prison system, and that's a BFD. Okay, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
See you tonight. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Harbinger, with you. This Charles Pierce just really, you know, really, really takes Bill Kristol apart. And if anybody deserves it, geez. I mean, at what point are we going to start just looking back or looking around and saying, really, we want more wars? I mean, you know, really, we wanted those wars? We want to have 20,000+, 30,000+, you know, injured soldiers. We want to have 4,000+. I mean, when Galloway gave his speech, it was only 1,600 dead Americans. Now it's over 4,000. It was only 100,000 dead Iraqis. Now it's probably 500,000. Not to mention the explosion of birth defects that's going on in Iraq right now as a result of our covering that country with depleted uranium, which in and of itself should be considered a war crime. We didn't go to Iraq and say, hey, let's have an election and see if you want to join Iran, which is kind of what they've done now. Now we just started dropping bombs. Saddam Hussein was going, I got nothing. I got no weapons of mass destruction. You can go anywhere in the country and look. We did. Scott Ritter went over. He went from one end of the country to the other, inside, outside, above, below, everywhere. He says, there's nothing here. George Bush says, I don't care. You got that Cindy Sheehan clip? Yeah. This is, I mean, you know, we should have known, right? Back in 1998, when the Project for a New American Century, signed by Jeb Bush and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, when back in 1998, when they wrote a letter to Bill Clinton saying, we need to take out Saddam Hussein. We need to put a footprint in the middle of the Middle East. Iraq is in the middle of the Middle East. You can't get more central than Iraq. Plus, as Dick Cheney famously said, Iraq sits on top of 10% of the oil reserves. Very significant reserves. Second only to Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And then we learn. That George W. Bush, when he had decided to run for president, his mommy and daddy hired a ghostwriter to write his autobiography. And the first ghostwriter they hired was an old family friend, Mickey Herskowitz. Herskowitz recorded about 100 hours of tape with George, and he wrote the first draft. It didn't suck up enough, so they hired a second ghostwriter. But the book is still in print. It's called A Charge to Keep by George W. Bush. And Herskowitz went on the record. He had a conversation with a reporter. I think it was Robert Perry. He had a conversation with a reporter in which he quoted George W. Bush. Now, this was back in 1999. This was before he had even announced he was going to run for president. And Cindy Sheehan, before Congress, testifying before John Conyers Commission, she quotes Mickey Herskowitz quoting George W. Bush back a year before he even ran for president about how his father really blew it in Iraq because he didn't, you know, he had a 100-hour war. It was a three-day war. If he had had that war running all the way up to the next election, he would have, you know, he would have beat Bill Clinton in 92. He would have become president. Bill Clinton's presidency never would have happened if George Herbert Walker Bush had simply extended his war. And George W. Bush, being no dummy about these things, made this comment.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
There you go. And I'm going to have a successful presidency. And his definition of a successful presidency, you'll remember after he won re-election in 2004, after the state of Ohio had their vote count run through electronic machines that then reported to tabulators that at about midnight transferred all the vote counts over to Kentucky and then, you know, to the server that Karl Rove was running and then went back to Ken Blackwell. Back when... when George won re-election by a whisker, he said, I'm going to use my political capital to privatize Social Security. And he made a serious effort to do it. At what point are we going to start looking at this stuff and go, you know, this is just plain old, flat-out criminal stuff? Okay, Joe in Chevy Chase says libertarians don't stand for big corporations.
They don't. I mean, the big corporations, fine, but not. They're very avid advocates of strong antitrust and competitive laws. I mean, you can couch it however you wish. Also find it.
No, not true.
Well, oh yeah, you're there. You know, I
was in the Libertarian Party and back in 1986. Or 1976, excuse me.
So they support monopolies?
Charles Koch started ran for president on the Libertarian banner. They absolutely do not support things like the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Sherman Antitrust Act is considered by libertarians to be government interference in the marketplace.
Well, okay. I've got many sources to prove you wrong, but I also find it interesting.
No, you don't.
that I find it. I find
Name
it
one.
Okay. You know, you have a very prominent role on Russian television, and I find it very interesting that you're spending all this time right now spouting about how much war criminals.
So you lose your argument. You're going off on an ad hominem. My TV show is syndicated to both RT and Free Speech TV, and I'm pleased to have the carriage, just like I would be pleased if Al Jazeera was picking it up. Or, you know, if, you know, enough. Al, we hit the machine. Okay. Patty, let me put you on hold. Sorry about that. 28 minutes past the hour. My show, just for the record, my show being carried by RT has absolutely nothing to do with my agreeing with Ron Paul that America has no interest in Crimea or Ukraine. I think that's just common sense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And libertarians want to get rid of big government. Why? So that the billionaires and the big corporations can run things. It's very simple. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's really interesting. Whenever I get phone calls from the suburbs of Washington, D.C., it seems that they're typically people who work for right-wing think tanks in this town. Rush Limbaugh has this whole paranoid theory that there are program callers who are paid to call into his show. I don't know about that. I don't know if anybody like that is calling into my show, but it's the strangest thing. So, but let's take Joe. Let's assume that Joe actually isn't an idiot or a useful idiot or a paid shill, and that he actually has some legitimate concern. Can anybody explain to me why we should risk going to war, or for that matter, losing Russia as an ally after they pulled our bacon out of the fire in both Iran and Syria? Why we would want to make an enemy of the only other country that has, you know, 5,000 nuclear weapons? What our interest is in Ukraine that's so compelling it's worth provoking Russia over? If you can explain that to me, I mean, maybe I'll change my mind. But I just don't see it. I'm with Ron Paul on this. Patty, in Poncha Springs, Colorado. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Well, it's a wonderful day in Poncha Springs, Colorado, and I just wanted to tell you, anyone that calls and promotes war should be on the front lines, and I just can't imagine what reason it would possibly have other than maybe to make more money.
Yeah, well, that's the, you know, callers from the Beltway here. You know, we're surrounded by we've got two of the wealthiest zip codes in the entire United States. It used to be Beverly Hills. Now it's Virginia. It's right on the border of Washington, D.C., and it's where you get these defense contractors, you know, living in their 35-bedroom mansions with their servants' quarters next door and their five Bentleys in the driveway, and their private jet out at IAD or at the private airport. And I'm with you, Patty. I'm with you. It's a disgusting state of affairs. Jack in Denver, listening to AM 760. Hey, Jack.
I drive it off.
Jack, you are on the air.
Right there. Be right there.
Okay.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Jack.
Still there, Tom?
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to say that, you know, I wasn't discounting the pretext on Iraq, and I'm not trying to discount or refute that, but Saddam kind of brought the thing on by himself.
What, by letting the UN weapons inspectors into his country?
No.
By asserting that he had no weapons of mass destruction?
No, Tom, by what he did. And we all have to acknowledge this. And even it did after the fact. We had an FBI agent that infiltrated, befriended him in prison and asked him why he did that. He played the rope-a-dope.
Did
back.
What?
What he would do is he'd say, you can't inspect here now. I'll let you in a few days. To give the illusion, perhaps, and I think in hindsight, that he did, in fact, possess something. The reason he did that, of his own admission, was
so his neighbors wouldn't invade him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he still did it, Tom. He didn't give us.
But we knew he had nothing. Jack, if you're saying that that's a reason to invade a country, I got a list of about 30 countries for you. No, are you really trying to make an argument that we should have invaded Iraq because Saddam Hussein would not say, no, I absolutely, you can anytime, anyway. I mean, do you know how many countries have weapons of mass destruction?
Sure, but I firmly believe, I believe there's a strong chance, and I wonder if you do as well, that if Saddam didn't play that rope-a-dope tactic, if he would still not be in power. I think he might be.
He would still not be in power because George Bush had decided that he needed to have a war so that he could privatize Social Security and get reelected. He told his biographer that in 1999. The very first cabinet meeting he had, and a member of his cabinet, whose name I can't remember now, but he was his Secretary of Commerce, wrote a book about this, about how the very first cabinet meeting they had in January of 2001, long before 9/11, the first topic that was brought up was, how are we going to invade Iraq? And this guy's looking around going, what? Really? And you know, there have been numerous Bush administration officials who have now come forward and said that. You know, Cheney was cherry-picking intelligence. He was harassing the CIA. These guys wanted to have a war, and they wanted to have a war for purely political reasons. And that, in my opinion, is a war crime. Tom in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Tom.
Yes, Tom. You brought up Abby Huntsman a little while ago on your show that I was watching, and I was really upset about it when I heard her the other day speak about cutting Social Security. This is a woman who inherited. She's a billionaire through the Huntsman trust fund.
Well, it's always the billionaires and the billionaires who are saying cut Social Security because they're never going to have to live on it, so they don't give a rat's ass about the average person in America.
Very, very true. I've written articles for over 25 years. The Republicans on Wall Street started a campaign over 25 years ago to cut Social Security because they were looking at the baby boomers retiring and they were saying they're going to take all this money away from Wall Street and we want our hands on it.
Right.
So I wrote editorials back 25 years ago in the Chicago Sun-Times defending Social Security and Medicare. And about 10 years ago, I'm headed of a progressive political action committee to get progressive Democrats into U.S. Congress. And we've got 20 members that we've supported over the last 10 years and that are in Congress. 14 are still in Congress right now, and a couple are running for Senate, as a matter of fact. But, you know, this campaign was instigated by Wall Street in order to get their hands on that money.
I know, and Wall Street billionaire Pete Peterson is behind an awful lot of it. He spent several $100 million of his own money. And the reason why is because in 1983, Ronald Reagan and Alan Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan looked at the coming retirement of the baby boomers starting around, you know, the late 90s and said, you know, this is a demographic bulge. There's about a 5 or 6% increase in population that the baby boomers represent. And when that rabbit starts moving through the python of Social Security, they're going to caught, you know, up until that point, Social Security never had a trust fund. Social Security was entirely funded with taxes, and every year they would adjust that Social Security tax up or down depending on how much money they needed to be able to pay retirees. So working people were paying for the retirement of their parents and grandparents. And in 83, they came up with this brilliant idea, let's double tax the boomer generation. Let's tax them not only for the retirement of their parents and grandparents, but let's also tax them for their own retirement and put it in a savings account. And so they created a Social Security trust fund, and they doubled, literally doubled, the Social Security tax on the first $40,000 of income, which is now the first $118,000, I think, of income. And they literally doubled the Social Security tax, and the other half of that money went into a trust fund. And that trust fund right now is $2.6 trillion. And these guys like Pete Peterson on Wall Street are looking at that $2.6 trillion saying, if we could get our hands on that money, think what we could do. I mean, just skimming 1% off the top, and Wall Street does a whole lot more than that. If you have an IRA throughout your working life, odds are as much as 40% of it goes to fees, for IRA administration fees and churn, IRAs and 401ks. They always figure out a way to get their piece. And that's what this is all about. That's the Republican talking point. And I am horrified that Abby Huntsman, who seems like an otherwise intelligent person, would buy that load of, well, whatever you can't say on the radio. Tom, there we go. Thank you, Tom, for the call. Kirk in Cal Navarre, Nevada. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Hey, I was just listening to you on this the war in Iraq and all that. First of all, I got this. I just wondered if you'd read this book, Known and Unknown, by Donald Rumsfeld.
No, I didn't. I did. I think I had him on this show. I think we interviewed Don Rumsfeld when his book came out, but I didn't.
Okay, well, I'm going to read it. Then I'm reading some other stuff, too, and I'll get back with you on it.
Okay.
This thing in Iraq, it's. I remember it coming up on the TV years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, number one, we had Saddam Hussein, I mean Iraq, we had a no-fly zone over the whole thing. He couldn't even get a plane off the ground.
Right.
It was a total scam that we went over there.
And we had run such an embargo on Iraq for years and years and years that they didn't have chlorine for their water systems. Over a 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of our embargo, which started during the Clinton administration. And or actually started during the first Bush administration and then was continued during the Clinton administration. And I mean, we had taken that country down. We had taken a prosperous, fully developed, you know, emerging secular country in the Middle East and turned it into a third world nation before we started bombing.
That's right. That's right. Listen, there's I don't know if you've read it. I read it years ago and I've bought copies of it and given it to my fellow union brothers that were, I'm a pipe fitter and a welder, retired just last year. But anyway, it's called Friends in High Places, The Bechtel Story. And yeah. Listen, they're all tied in with the Koch brothers and everybody.
Oh, and you track Bechtel back to the Nixon administration. I mean, that his, you know, Caspar Weinberger was a former head of Bechtel.
That's correct.
So yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, the most interesting thing, you mentioned Don Rumsfeld. He had a book come out when people's books come out, they go on lecture on TV shows, radio shows, and he did, what was it, Opie and Anthony? He did one of these shows with these two funny guys, and they had a comedian on. The guy kept asking Donald Rumsfeld. You can easily Google this; it's up on YouTube. Kept asking him if he was actually a lizard person, and Donald Rumsfeld repeatedly refused to answer the question over and over and over again. He refused to answer the question about whether or not he was actually a lizard person. I'm beginning to wonder. Kirk, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your thoughts on my thoughts on the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Franklin, watching Free Speech TV in New York City on cable TV. Hey, Franklin.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What cable system are you watching this on?
Time Warner.
Oh, cool.
Who else?
Yeah.
There aren't that many. They're beginning to, they've been consolidating the control of cable television.
I know, it's mind-boggling.
Time. But the reason I'm calling is pertaining to this Crimea, Ukraine, Russian situation.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line, as I see it, and I think it's obvious, is that the corporate oligarchy is at the bottom, and it is at their behest and command that the Western governments are moving against the Russians. First of all, it's only in the last few days, and this has been going on for a few weeks, that the historical reality of Crimea has even been discussed, and that is, for centuries, Crimea has been a part of Russia.
It was part of Russia before the United States became a country.
Yes, and in various ways, it's been part of Russia for the past millennium.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, following World War II, our country and the United States and the Western countries, the powers of the Western countries, France and England, have been involved in dozens and dozens of wars. So one aspect of it is, who's fighting these wars? Who is going to go and kill, go and bleed, go and die, and go and maim? Working class people.
Right.
That's who. I think part of the answer to this is to institute. And what happens is, as salaries are suppressed and jobs disappear, more and more young men and women turn to the military, literally, for their life, to sustain their lives, for employment.
Yeah, this is what Thomas Jefferson said.
We should begin to discuss is instituting a universal draft in this in the United States. You reach a certain age, your name goes into a pool, and randomly these names are pulled out, and you have to serve a year or two or whatever it is.
I think every high school graduate in the United States should serve give a year of service to their country. They should be able to choose whether it's military service or whether it's working for a nonprofit, but they should do that. And in exchange for that year of service to their country, which would be a great rite of passage, I mean, there's a biological and psychological imperative that makes this a healthy thing as well as a political one. In exchange for that year of service, they should get a free college education.
Right. And
or trade school or whatever they want.
To this, regardless of your economic status, I do believe that you'll begin to see our government engaging in other ways to deal with these conflicts.
Yep.
Rather than going to war.
Yeah. Oh, look at what happened in the military during the latter years of Vietnam when you know you started. I mean, it was all these conscripts, all these draftees were there. And they were like, wait a minute, you know, do we really want to be doing this? I don't think so. I'm totally with you, Franklin. And you know who's probably the lead champion for this in the United States Congress is Charlie Rangel. And now they're saying Charlie Rangel shouldn't run for another term. Charlie Rangel is so good on this topic. I mean, you know, he might have some personal life oddities, but I think he's a hell of a good member of Congress. Franklin, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching us there in New York City. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Corky, Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, this is another attempt to resurrect the Soviet Union, the big bad boogeyman, because Iran didn't do it for us. Iraq didn't do it for us. And the Al-Qaeda's not doing it for us. We have to find a way to extract money from the working middle class by scaring them into the big, bad Soviet Union with the nukes.
Right.
We got to be afraid of
Well,
the
now
nukes.
It's not the Soviet Union. Now it's a big, bad Russia.
Yeah, Russia.
But yeah, it's the Cold War all
and
over.
And also, if you scare them enough to panic them, they will allow you to cut your Social Security.
Yep.
They will allow you to privatize your Social Security. If you can make an argument for why you need this money to fight those Soviets so they don't explode their nukes on us.
Right, right.
They will allow you to do that. And they're making a desperate attempt to do this right now.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. The neocons, the Bill Kristols among us are just, you know, and now Rand Paul has jumped into the fray, and John McCain was over in Kiev trying to crank things up, just like he went to Georgia, you know, with Saakashvili, Misha Saakashvili, who is, you know, who then McCain got $1 billion to afterwards. I mean, this whole thing is so corrupt. Corky, thank you for the call. Ben in Merrillville, Indiana. Hey, Ben. You got a letter from Senator Murphy?
Yes, sir. And it's outrageous. It's truly outrageous. This guy went over there with
over where?
And Durbin over to the Ukraine just recently and came back with those six McCain, Durbin, Barrasso, White House, Mulvin, and Flake.
Yeah.
And did he ever get a bill of goods to bring back and send me a personal letter? He's not my senator, but I wanted to ask you, what in the hell do these people have in mind when they can use our tax money to go over there into a country that we should have nothing to do with?
Yeah, what they're thinking about is the next election. And what they're thinking about are the people who are donating to their campaigns for the next election. And among the largest of those donors here in Washington, D.C., are the multimillionaires and billionaires who live in the giant mansions with 20 and 30 servant staffs surrounding Washington, D.C., and run the think tanks and have the lobbying firms here in Washington, D.C. It is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. It is the defense industry that is hugely privatized thanks to Reaganomics. And therefore, those private corporations are able to hand off massive amounts of money to politicians. If you had the Defense Department working the way it did back during the Eisenhower administration, when it was all government, you can't have, you know, the Defense Department can't go to a congressman and say, here, have some money for your campaign. But a defense contractor sure can, and they sure do. And that's what's going on, Ben. It's real simple. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I got a call from my sister. You know, she works with senior citizens, and she's hearing, they're hearing this stuff with President Obama. They're blaming him on everything now. They're saying that he wants to get us into a war and everything.
Right.
But, you know, what really gets me is all the saber-rattling talk that all this stuff about these, sanctions and everything, it's amounting to saber-rattling to talk like that. They're going to end up wordsmithing us right into a war. Now, I can't understand them. I hear the voices of Kerry. I hear the voices of Obama. To me, it sounds like, if you keep pushing Russia's buttons, we're going to end up going into war with them because they're going to exhaust all their options, and the next thing you know, we're going to be on the front line. And the truth of the matter is, too, is I think our vice president, his son is in the military, and you can bet your boots, just like all these politicians, if they get us into a war, you won't find any of their kids on the front line when 11 Bravo MOS. And any GI that's listening to what I'm saying knows exactly what I'm talking about. And another thing, too, we should just stay out of that thing, pretty much like you were saying, too, that, that we don't... The Crimea has always been part of Russia anyway. The American people better start screaming about this and carrying signs and everything because it's going to hurt us. And as far as draft is concerned, I think if they have to go to war, everybody should get drafted. And that gives them the option that they can go and work for a civil
service. Yeah, we should get Charlie Rangel back on this show again. It's been a long time since he's been here. I'm with you, Donald. Thank you. Well said. Christine in Mayport, Pennsylvania.
Hi. Whenever I call legislators, I ask them to hold out their hands, or their aides, to hold out their hands and ask them to point to the palm of their hand and remember corporations, notably the ones that in this case are the weapons contractors, don't care about jobs. Look at your four fingers and remember they don't want unions. They don't want benefits. They do want long hours. They do want low wages. Stick out your thumb and remember that they do want no regulation in or out of the workplace. Make a fist and remember it's always about the money.
Yeah, very, very well said, Christine. Thank you for that. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse.
Hi, Tom. Hey, connecting the dots, always from Egypt to Ukraine and Venezuela, always it seems when the rich is in trouble, they start wars.
Yep.
And they don't have no answers for jobs. Ukraine, you give everybody jobs, you have peace. You give everybody jobs in Egypt, you have peace. You give everybody jobs in whatever's going to happen in the future here in America, they would, have peace. So the only way I see around it is identifying the people instead of left and right, Republican, communist, capitalist. Everybody should identify with the 99%. And just say, hey, Bernie Sanders, start a progressive economy for the people.
Yeah.
Let's forget all this garbage.
You know, there's a petition out there to encourage Bernie to run for president in the Democratic primaries. And I'm all in favor of that. You can see it over at pdamerica.org. And in fact, I'm going to be signing a letter later this week or maybe early next week that we're going to send out saying Bernie, run as a Democrat in the primaries. I don't know the mechanics of it. I don't know the legality of it, but not legality, but the mechanics of it. I don't know how it works with the parties. But I intend to ask him this Friday because I think that we need. Thank you for the call, Rick. I think we need somebody like Bernie in the Democratic Party in the primaries for president. Speaking out, Bernie Sanders could be this generation's Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy didn't win the White House, but he sure did move his party to the left. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. And yesterday we were talking about the possibility humans might vanish from the Earth as a result of global warming getting into an unstoppable positive feedback loop, a downward spiral. But this is very interesting. Wesley Smith, who is a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, is the author of a book called The War on Humans. You can read about it over at discovery.org, and Wesley is with us. Hey, Wesley, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, good talking to you again.
Thank you for joining us again. Are people no better than rocks, maggots, and squirrels? You know, from the point of view of biological systems, from the point of view of the planet, I would suggest that probably we're not as good as rocks, maggots, and squirrels because they're staying within their ecological niche, and we have reached the point where we're consuming more than half of all the fresh water on the planet. We're consuming about half the net photosynthetic productivity of the planet. We're driving to extinction dozens, if not hundreds, of species every day. Yeah, I got a problem with that.
Yeah, well, so you're anti-human.
No, I'm not anti-human. I'm anti sick culture. We did not behave this way toward the planet until the last couple hundred years.
You know, the planet doesn't have a point of view. And secondly, it's only in the last couple of hundred years that human beings have had existences that you could even call prosperous. It's only in the last few hundred years that we've been able to defeat disease and not have a hand-to-mouth form of miserable existence.
Well, if you really believe that, you've never bothered to study anthropology.
The very things that brought us prosperity and freedom.
Are you familiar with the phrase white Indians?
No.
Okay. I would strongly recommend that you go back and read the history of the early settlers from Europe, of North America, and starting with Jamestown, and you know, basically for the first 100 years or so, the very large number, the very real problem that these European settlers had, most of them were, you know, here on behalf of the East India Company. A lot of the labor that they brought with them was poor Europeans who had indentured themselves or had come over for a job. They got here, they got to know the American Indians, the Native Americans in the communities around them, and they said, wow, life is really good for these people, and life really sucks here in these American colonies. There's disease, there's death, there's plagues and famines and all kinds of weird, you know, and I'm going to become an Indian. And they called them white Indians. There were a lot of tribes and a lot of communities on this continent.
Live in a tent somewhere, do away with running water, and not have electricity to run your show.
Well, they didn't have electricity back then. The Europeans didn't have electricity either.
It was much harder because they didn't. What would be the best thing that could happen for the African continent, for the people living in Africa? Electrify the entire continent. Have a grid on the continent.
Not if they do it with fossil fuels.
We can't do that because it'll destroy the earth, keeping people mired in destitution and misery. I can't imagine that you as a good liberal want that.
You're making a straw man argument, a false argument. There are places across Africa where they are putting, in fact, I've been there. I've seen these operating in South Sudan and in Kenya, where relief groups are going in and they're putting in solar panels to run pumps to bring fresh water out of aquifers so that people can have access to fresh water.
And it burns fossil
fuels.
How many decades do you think it will be to do that kind of little solar thing, which I'm for, before the whole continent can be a grid?
Well, it took Germany 10 years to reach the point where 40% of the total electricity was generated by solar power.
Solar power isn't going to be the answer in this world for decades. And so
it took Germany 10 years to hit 40%.
Tired in disease and misery for decades. What a compassionate
Wesley, are you listening to me?
What a compassionate, wonderful, caring man you are.
Have you heard anything I've said?
Let the people go down the drain.
Wesley, let me say it again. It took Germany 10 years to reach the point where they could generate 40% of their electricity with solar power. 10 years. You asked how long is it going to take to solarize Africa? I think, you know, with a significant investment and a buy-in from the people of Africa, you could do it in a decade.
I don't think so, but let's hope so. But in the meantime, let's get it going with things that we know will work now. Let's electrify Africa. And by the way, I don't know how you expect to have people follow an environmental movement in which some of the main voices are now beginning to call us a cancer on the planet, a plague on the planet, supporting China's one-child policy that involves forced abortion and female infanticide. That's the end of the environmental movement. You wonder why environmental movement has lost a lot of its following in this country? Take a look at the anti-humanism that has replaced the positive environmentalism that cleaned up our water and cleaned up our air.
So you think that 7 billion humans on the planet is a good thing?
I think that the way to...
How many more should we have? Should we become 10?
You want to let me answer the question or just
sure.
Be a lecture?
Go for it.
Thank you very much. The way to handle the number of people on the planet is to increase prosperity. The more their people are prosperous, the fewer children they will have. But if you want to go down the road of the China one-child policy, like Sir David Attenborough does and many other advocates for global warming, you're talking about instilling a form of tyranny. I can't believe you would want forced abortion, Tom, as a way of...
Again, you're suggesting straw man. I have never suggested any of those things.
I'm asking you. You defended China's one-child policy.
No, I didn't.
Well, then I'm saying you cannot...
You just made that up.
...policy. You cannot have that kind of a policy. And
no, if you want a very simple way to reduce population, it's not increasing prosperity. It's giving education and political power to women. Now, when you do that... Regardless of the level of prosperity, population drops.
We will totally agree. Let's increase power for women, and let's increase education for women, and let's increase prosperity, because the more prosperous people are, the smaller families they feel comfortable having.
Not necessarily. The if you look at Saudi Arabia, you look at Qatar, you look at these countries in the Middle East where people are given $40,000 a year from the government as a baseline, right? Everybody's rich. They still have 11 children as an average family size.
That happens to be.
It's got nothing to do with prosperity. It has to do with the power of women.
Now, that has to do with also a religious perspective.
It has to do with a religion that oppresses women, just like fundamentalist Christianity does.
Well, I don't care about fundamentalist Christianity or Islam in this regard. We need to increase prosperity. People will have smaller children, and we certainly should.
No, it's not prosperity.
Let me ask you, Tom, do you condemn China's one-child policy unequivocally?
Sure.
Good. Well, see, there's another area of agreement. But those who don't condemn it, in fact, those who support it, I contend, are anti-human.
You're saying 7 billion people on the planet is just fine. We have more than half of us, about 5 billion of us, are living on less than $2 a day. If all 7 billion of us lived at the standard of living, the poverty level in the United States, it would take 4 planet Earths to provide the natural resources to make all the junk that we would all be consuming. Where are you going to get that from?
We're going to, first off, with technology, and secondly, what I'm talking about is not engaging in policies that would be destructive to the people who are alive on this planet today, and to promote the kind of policies that you and I agree on. More power for women, and I wish you believed in more prosperity, as opposed to a lot of environmentalists who talk about deep...
I'm very concerned about your definition of prosperity.
Well, let's just talk about
how many more people can this planet withstand?
I don't know. It depends on our technology.
You don't think we're overpopulated right now?
I think we probably are a little overpopulated.
So what are you going to do about it?
I'm not going to engage in one-child type policies. In fact, did you?
So what are you going to do about it?
Policy of China. They have. Not
what are you going to do about it?
I'm not going to do anything except what you have agreed to, which is improve prosperity, which is to improve power for women, to improve education for women, to give people better technology, to grow, to have more electricity in these poor places, and engage in pro-human environmentalism, not this anti-humanism, you're no better than a squirrel monster.
Okay, well,
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I do think from the point of view of the planet, and I disagree, I think it is sentient, that we are no better than a squirrel. Wesley Smith, discovery.org, can read all about it. Thank you, Wesley.
Thank you, Tom.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is interesting. I've got to read this article. But in the meantime, pick up some of your phone calls here. Rick, watching Free Speech TV in Las Vegas. Hey, Rich. Rick, thank you for watching Dish Network. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Could you please explain how the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be able to have our laws amended to conform with the partnership? And doesn't that take the power away from the Congress to make laws? And if we put that much power in the hands of those corporations, I hate to say it, but isn't that a form of fascism?
Yeah. Yeah, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is surrendering the sovereignty of the United States, the government of the United States, to transnational corporations. Transnational corporations can sue us, our governments, all the way from our federal government down to your town. They can sue us if we pass any laws that will inhibit their profits, regardless of what we're trying to protect ourselves from or what behavior of theirs we're trying to protect ourselves against. If it's going to inhibit their profits, they can sue us. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which should be appropriately called the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, SHAFTA, following on the heels of NAFTA and CAFTA, we now have SHAFTA. This is an abomination. It should not pass. We should not. I guarantee you that right after the elections, as we go into the lame duck session here in late November, early December of this year, you're going to see Congress try to pass fast track. You're going to see the president pushing for it. And we need to be very vigilant about this. We need to pay attention to it. We need to be lobbying our members of Congress to say no on fast track, no on SHAFTA. Making sense? Okay. Thank you, Rick. I appreciate the call. Elijah in Wrightsboro, Texas. Hey, Elijah. What's up?
No, I'm in San Saba, Texas, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in San Saba, Texas.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah, I heard a caller say a while ago when he called in that Russia, that was part of Russia at one time. And I looked it up in one of my old geography books, and he is completely correct.
Yeah.
And I don't see what the big deal is. I mean,
Crimea was part of Russia back when the Catholic Church ran most of Europe.
Yes, it certainly was. So what?
And they had an election in Crimea.
I don't understand why they're making such a big fuss unless they wanted to move NATO in so close to Russia over there. If that's what upset Putin.
Oh yeah, and that's what's going on. Back when Mikhail Gorbachev and George Herbert Walker Bush during the first Bush administration. As the Soviet Union was disintegrating in, I think it was 91, Bush Sr. and Gorbachev struck a deal on the orderly disintegration of the Soviet Union. And part of that deal was that the countries that border the Soviet Union that have historically been border Russia, that were historically part of the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine, that those countries would serve as a buffer, as a neutral buffer between Russia and Western Europe, and they would not join NATO. And that deal was broken during the Clinton administration, and in breaking that deal, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland are now members of NATO, and now Obama wants to follow in Bush's footsteps and put missiles in Poland. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. I'm looking at a piece in the Straits Times. First of all, I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, whether humans are better than squirrels and whether there's a war on humans and whether I'm part of it. I don't know. It could be. I kind of like humans. I like squirrels, too. In any case, I'm looking at the Straits Times. The Straits Times is the New Sunday Times, a newspaper out of Hong Kong. And the headline is Malaysian Airlines cuts costs to stay competitive. It starts out with a quote. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Captain ABC speaking. It is free seating this morning on our flight as the plane is only half full, but I will appreciate it if you occupy the window seats so our competitors think the flight is full. Thank you. And then it goes on. You laugh until your sides ache, but it's not such a rib-tickling affair for airlines when they have to pilot their way out of the turbulence, which has now beset the industry. And then basically it's a story about how Malaysia Airlines is having to cut. Their revenues were down 12.1%. They lost RM $3.79 billion. I'm assuming RM is renminbi, the Chinese currency, because this is a story out of Hong Kong, that they are going to be selling six aircraft in the current financial year, two B-747s, a B-747-300, a B-737-200, a DC-10, and an Airbus A-300, and that they are bringing in a guy to run the airline who has no airline experience but has experience as basically a corporate raider. Now, there are two things. You know, I have not weighed in yet on this Malaysian Airlines where did the damn plane go thing yet. But I'm going to now. I'm a pilot. I'm not a commercial pilot, but I know how airplanes work. And there are two theories that make a certain amount of sense to me. The theory that only partially makes sense to me is that there was some sort of a fire in the cockpit, there was some sort of a meltdown in the plane that caused the pilot. Pilots, when they program their ACAR system, when they program their automatic flight system, very often, typically, pilots put in an A program and a B program. The A program is where we're going. We're going to fly from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. And then you put in a B program that takes you back to Kuala Lumpur. And then about halfway through your trip, you reprogram that B program to take you to some other airport that's nearby. Or even periodically, you can reprogram that. And that B program is there in case you have an emergency, in case you lose an engine, in case you hit really severe turbulence and start losing your hydraulics or something. If anything happens, then you simply push a button on your autopilot, and the autopilot switches from your A program to your B program, and now the plane is flying itself back to an airport that's nearby rather than all the way to Beijing. This is standard operating practice. So if the pilots were in the cockpit and they had an emergency, and that emergency was starting to take out their systems, for example, if it had taken out the transponder, and then the ACAR system, a smart pilot would have pushed that button and said, let's go back to Kuala Lumpur, and the plane would have executed that left turn. Now, here's the problem with that theory. The problem with that theory is that if they had properly programmed that ACAR systems for that return to Kuala Lumpur, that plane would have automatically landed in Kuala Lumpur. Current generation Airbuses are capable of going from 30,000 feet to landing at an airport without the pilot ever touching anything. And it didn't. It made a turn, and then it kept on going. Which leads me to my theory. And now this is not, you know, I don't feel strongly about this. I don't believe this with a high level of certainty. But I'm surprised that nobody else is bringing it up. And I think the reason nobody else is bringing it up is because it has to do with corporate America. Malaysian Airlines was in trouble financially. They had brought in a guy to slash their budget, which means laying off people. And they were selling off planes, which means laying off pilots. Who are you going to lay off? Well, Malaysia is basically a dictatorship. It's not a good democracy. You got a guy running the country who's, you know, tin pot dictator. And this pilot of this plane, if the news reports I've read are correct, was a big fan of a small D democratic opponent to the dictator of Malaysia, who was prosecuted the day of the flight or the day before the flight, was prosecuted for being homosexual, which is illegal in Malaysia, and was sent to prison for it. And according to some news reports, this specifically was in the Daily Mail, the British newspaper, The pilot actually went to the trial of his political hero, the guy who went to jail, who was the opposition leader. Now, I don't think that, you know, the theory was that's enough for the pilot to want to commit suicide. I don't think so. I think here's what happened. I think the pilot was a supporter of the opposition. That got back to the government and to the management of the airline. They decided, hey, we're doing cutbacks. We've got to get rid of some of our pilots. We're going to get rid of this guy. And the day that he flew, given that the management was so incompetent, I'm willing to bet that we're going to someday find out that he had been laid off that day or fired. And that might be a good reason to take an airplane and go fly out to the middle of the Indian Ocean and ditch it. He was in his 50s. It was the end of his career. This was the only thing he loved and cared about was aviation. That airplane simulator that he had in his garage, he built by hand. It was homemade. But Malaysia doesn't want to say this because it's such a badly run country, and the company doesn't want to say this because it's such a badly run company. And I've been in Malaysia. I've been in Kuala Lumpur. They didn't want to say it because it's embarrassing. And I predict this someday is going to come out, that the result of this crash, that the provocation for this crash was corporate cutbacks. And that's why the corporate media in America is not talking
about it. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, I will admit that that sounds like an absolutely wackadoodle conspiracy theory, and it may well be. Listen. The good, the bad, and the very, very ethmoidly ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, the Department of the Interior. On Friday, the department okayed a plan to give over $3.2 million in federal grants to fund 21 different renewable energy projects on Native American lands. Projects include a plan to build a wind farm strong enough to power 30,000 homes in California, and a plan to build a wind farm to power a Crow Creek Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. According to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, these grants are about strengthening self-determination and self-governance by enabling tribal nations to evaluate and promote their energy and mineral assets. Helping people rebuild their local economies and helping them go green at the same time, what could be better? The bad, Wyoming. That state has rejected new federal science standards because they required students to actually learn science. According to Wyoming State Representative Matt Teeters, a Republican who wrote a footnote in the state's budget rejecting the new requirements, the standards place too much emphasis on global warming. He told the Casper Star Tribune, quote, "The standards handle global warming as settled science. There's all kinds of social implications involved in that I don't think would be good for Wyoming." End of quote. Wyoming's education chief seconded Teeters' worries, saying, quote, "I don't accept personally that climate change is a fact. The standards are very prejudiced, in my opinion, against fossil fuel development." End quote. And people wonder why Americans rank so poorly on worldwide education rankings. And the very, very ugly Pat Robertson. During a recent broadcast of the 700 Club, the televangelist implied that a caller's cancer was the result of her inability to forgive her dead and abusive father. Seriously. He said, "You have a feeling of loss and emptiness, and you've sort of turned off the tremendous system that you have to prevent. There's an immune system that will function when you are forgiving. You cannot keep harboring it. It will hurt yourself." I'm sure Jesus would blame people for their cancer too, Pat. That's just very, very ugly. It's amazing. So Shane just shared with me this story by Chris Goodfellow, published over at Wired.com. It's titled A Startlingly Simple Theory About the Missing Malaysia Airlines Jet. And it answers one of the questions that I raised about, well, what if there was a fire? Why didn't the ACAR system, why didn't the autopilot continue taking them to an airport? And this pilot, this guy who is a commercial pilot, I am not, I'm a private pilot. This guy who is a commercial pilot, he says that, you know, if you had a serious fire, and he talks actually about a couple of cases where this happened, where the the front wheel, the front tire was on fire. Now, this was a heavy plane that took a long, long takeoff. That's the kind of thing that can catch a tire on fire. And then the fire comes up into the wheel well, and the tire on fire is blowing smoke through the wheel well into the plane. And it's very toxic smoke, and first of all, a fire could spread, but secondly, just the smoke could be enough to kill everybody on the plane. And so he said the first thing that the pilots would do is they'd pull the main bus, they'd pull the power, basically kill the power to the whole plane. Now, the engines would continue to run. It would kill the power to everything on the flight deck. And you could manually fly the plane using hydraulics. And he said this might account for why the guy flew the plane up to 45,000 feet, maybe trying to get into a low oxygen environment and put the fire out. But then at 45,000 feet, you're flying above the airplane's the envelope within which an airplane normally operates. The air is so thin at that altitude that you can't get much lift under the wings. So your stall speed window becomes very, very narrow. And if the plane stalled and spun out, or just stalled and dipped, it might take 20,000 feet to recover. So it falls really, really fast in a stall. Over 1 minute, it drops 20,000 feet, about 4 miles. And then it's got enough speed that the pilot can pull it out of the dive. Or the plane might just level itself. A plane, if you do nothing to it, will always fly straight and level and follow the heading that it's pointed, with variations for the wind around it. And so it may be that by that point in time, everybody on the plane was dead from the smoke and the fire. And the buses had been pulled, so the plane was not, responding to anything. There was nobody in the plane who could make a cell phone call. There was nothing because everybody was toast. And then the plane just flew for 7 hours till it ran out of fuel and ditched in the ocean. That makes a lot of sense to me, too. I didn't get the pulling the bus thing because I was wondering, if he'd programmed this into the flight control system, why didn't it continue to take him there? Okay, you pull the main bus, you're going to kill that too. So we'll see. Time will tell. But it may well be that this pilot was an absolute hero, that he was trying to bring his plane back safely, and the fire was just too big for him. So I'm thinking of recalibrating the airline job cut theory. That sounds a little wackier in the context of this. So anyhow, Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, thanks for listening to AM950. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. So many topics, so
yeah.
Little time. but I'm going to go back to what I called about. The whole Social Security thing, the Greenspan report. Now, I'm starting to hear, this is what I'm hearing on the news and other places, the same kind of talk about the 2014 election that I heard about 2010, and I wonder if it's trying to keep people away from voting. And when Abby Huntsman came out with her Social Security thing, that same week we had in one of our papers an editorial by a conservative stressing that the boomers have a job to do, and that's to give up their Social Security.
Right. But yeah, this is being orchestrated by Pete Peterson and the Peterson Institute. This guy's spent several $100 million promoting this idea for a decade or more. And there's a whole bunch of other Wall Street guys, and he's a Wall Street billionaire, and there's a whole bunch of other guys from Wall Street who want to basically have all of us, they don't like the idea of, because the easy solution is raising the cap. You raise the cap, all of a sudden they're going to have to pay 6% income tax,
right,
on their income.
Talk about
and secondly, they want to get a hold of that money.
Right. But when you talk about raising the cap, the calculation that was in, and I don't know if you ever read the Greenspan report, but it's really interesting. The calculation that they use to determine how much income Social Security should be paid on each year has been skewed because of the huge rise in CEO and top level salaries,
right,
versus the rise in other salaries.
Right.
So,
because when the Greenspan Commission was written, CEOs on average made 30 times what their workers made.
Yep.
And so you had a relatively small cohort who wasn't all that well paid, who weren't paying Social Security taxes, and you had a large cohort of middle class, high salaried factory workers who were paying Social Security taxes. Now that lower cohort, that lower group who was well paid, has been wiped out. They're not paying as much in Social Security taxes. And the high group that's making $400,000, $500,000, $1,000, $10,000 what their workers are making, they're not paying any Social Security taxes beyond the first $118,000.
And that's part of it. And then the other thing that was in that report is they knew that there were going to have to be further adjustments. And
sure.
I don't know. I'm giving them the benefit of doubt in saying that I assume that they expected Congress to act in the interim 30-plus years.
Oh, yeah. Well, that I know is in the report. And it used to be that Congress did this regularly. The cost of living adjustments were often voted on by Congress. Benefit changes were voted on by Congress. Changing the tax structure was voted on by Congress many, many times. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower in 1956, Google 1956 Republican platform. Dwight Eisenhower in the election of 56 when he was running for re-election, the Republican, one of the big things that he ran on was the fact that he had gotten through Congress legislation that expanded the number of people who were eligible for Social Security and increased the payments, the benefits for Social Security. He bragged about that. That's what he campaigned on in 1956.
Well, I think as somebody who's a part of the boomer generation, we should start talking about the great American heist of Social Security by the 1%.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I am totally with you. Carol, thanks for the call. Great, great comment. Mark in Fallbrook, California, listening to AM760's web stream. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Just fine.
Okay, Tom, you know, listening to the caller once again, many callers over time, when you try and interrupt and ask people where are their sources of facts, and we get into these loops of conversations where people don't even listen or stop to think where their information comes from. Tom, my question is, do we have any kind of process, or have there been a history of political parties trying to bring rationality back into the foreground? That is, make the question of where does your information come from come up earlier in the conversation so that we might educate a public in this next election cycle coming up.
If you go back and listen to the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960, and they're online, you can listen to them over the Kennedy Library or the Nixon Library, they cited sources. They quoted reality. When Reagan basically blew up the Fairness Doctrine in 87, and then Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 96, and we privatized our airwaves to the point that there was no longer an obligation to inform the public, and we moved from news to infotainment, that commitment to actually conveying truth vanished. And I would say a large chunk of our democracy has vanished with it. Mark, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it used to just be the zeitgeist, the sense of the times, the spirit of the times, the way things were, that you told the truth and you cited facts. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. For our Free Speech TV viewers, we just played that. Yesterday I was saying you got to watch this video, When Wolves Change Rivers, or How Wolves Change Rivers. And it's about how reintroducing the wolves to Yellowstone actually changed the rivers, the incredible impact that they had on the ecosystem. So anyway, we just shared that with you. You can find it on YouTube. It's easy to find. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, Goat.com. And Victoria, I see you are in the Talk Radio News luxury suite underneath the president's desk.
That's right. I am. That's where I am today. Have been all day. It's so nice here. You don't want to leave.
Yes. And I should say, you know, an entire floor below the president's desk. I don't want anybody thinking of Bill Clinton here.
No.
Okay. So what's going on in the world?
Federal Reserve further curtailed its economic stimulus campaign today, said it would reduce its monthly bond purchases again, so it's down another $10 billion to $55 billion in April. Also said that rates would remain at the current level, interest rates short-term near zero for a considerable time after it stops adding.
Now, let me get this straight. Did they say they're dialing back on quantitative easing?
They're going to keep doing their they're doing their tapering. They're going to taper another $10 billion
right.
in April.
Okay, so has the market reacted to that yet? I mean, I realize the market is closed. I think the market is closed.
Yeah, the market is closed.
But you've got the futures markets that will tell you what's going on.
Right, you've got the futures markets. I don't know what the futures markets is going to do, as a matter of fact. And Janet Yellen's, this was her very first press conference today as chair of the Fed. But the markets did close, and they closed down.
Yeah, interesting. And I'm looking at, S&P.
Not a lot. I mean, like half a point, a little over half a point, but they did close down.
Yeah, 0.6%, 0.7%
Yeah, and the interesting and the fascinating piece about how the markets like her.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, because she represents the status quo. I mean, she's basically following Bernanke's lead.
Yeah, but she's also, she is her own person, too.
Yes.
They also said that the growth in economic activity slowed during the winter months, in part reflecting adverse weather conditions. So they're saying it is partly the weather. So that was part of it. Also, the economic forecast today, officials expect slightly softer growth, slightly faster decline in the unemployment rate. They expect unemployment predicted to fall as low as 6.1 this year rather than 6.3. And in 2016, it will reach a new equilibrium between 5.2 and 5.6.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Was there any discussion? I'm guessing this is outside their purview of extending long-term unemployment benefits, or is that's entirely Congress, right?
That is Congress, and I don't know yet whether she was asked her views on that.
Okay.
Also today, Ukraine is drawing up plans to withdraw its soldiers and their families from Crimea, according to its security and defense chief. Andrei Paruby said they wanted to move them quickly and efficiently to mainland Ukraine. Paruby in a news conference also set out more on Kiev's position, said we're developing a plan that would enable us not only to withdraw servicemen, but also members of their family in Crimea so they could be quickly and efficiently moved to mainland Ukraine. They're also setting arrangements to introduce visas for Russian nationals traveling to Ukraine.
Very interesting. This is, I mean, it's like throwing pebbles at a wall. It's, What do they expect to have happen?
What do who expect?
I mean, is the administration saying that suddenly Russia is going to say, oh, gee, we're going to ignore the vote in Crimea. We're going to ignore everything that's happened up to this point. We're going to pull our soldiers out. We're going to give up our military bases. We're going to give Crimea back to Ukraine. I mean,
does anybody actually expect that? No, I don't think anybody believes that.
So what is the demand that they have in exchange for stopping the punishment?
I think at this point, to be realistic with you, this is just me thinking here, I think they want them to not go any further.
Oh, okay. So they're saying don't try and take East Ukraine.
Well, that's me thinking. They haven't said this.
Yeah.
But that
makes
realistically,
sense.
Realistically, they're going to – nobody thinks they're going to go back.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. A group representing major U.S. tech companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and the Chamber of Commerce is renewing the industry calls for immigration reform. What they're doing is they're keeping track of the number of jobs that it says are not created under the current system. They say that every few seconds of every business day, America loses another job that would have been created by a high-skilled immigrant who couldn't get a work visa. And so they've come up with numbers, basically, that would have been created. They say that the country does not create 500,000 jobs every year due to immigration limits.
Now, this is a little disingenuous because they really don't care about the roughly 10 to 12 million largely Hispanic folks in this country.
This is H-1B visas.
Right. What they want to be able to do, even though we have plenty of highly qualified and highly skilled engineers in this country, is they want to be able to bring them in from India. They want to bring in from India people who, with a PhD, who think that $50,000 a year is big money.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Well,
perhaps.
That's That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Very good.
back to you.
The federal judge today has admonished the Justice Department for repeatedly requesting overly broad searches of people's email accounts, a practice that he called repugnant to the Constitution.
Yes, it is.
It's an unusually harsh rebuke by Magistrate Judge John Facciola. And basically, it came in a kickback investigation involving a defense contractor. And he said that the government continues to submit overly broad warrants and makes no effort to balance the law enforcement interest against the obvious expectation of privacy email account holders have in their communications. He said his applicants ask for the entire universe of information tied to a particular account.
Wow. This is pushback that, I mean, it's starting at the grassroots now.
Yes.
Remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, and my apologies for the off color comment.
It's okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for accepting my apology. Ben, thank you for a great newscast. Great to have you with us, Victoria.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tim Carpenter, the Executive Director for Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, a group which is not affiliated with the Democratic Party, but works really hard to push the Democratic Party in a progressive direction.
Doing all we can, Tom, day in and day out.
Indeed. Tim Carpenter, the Executive Director, is here with us in the studio. Tim, it's always nice to see you in person.
I guess you can set your watch roundtable again today. Thanks for having us, Tom.
Sure. So before we get to the roundtable and to the progressive budget, because that was the main topic of the progressive roundtable here in D.C., you guys, Tom Hayden, I guess, signed a letter or is signing a letter, and I'm signing a letter.
Everybody who will sign is signing. We want to get Bernie to run.
Yeah. So tell me about this. Senator Sanders.
We want Bernie Sanders to run for president in the Democratic primary.
How does that work?
Well, he's making a lot of noises that he wants to run, and we certainly want him to run. Who better to defend single-payer and Social Security than Bernie Sanders? What we don't want is a repeat of Ralph Nader. We don't want an independent candidacy in September. What we'd like to see is Bernie to join with us that are fighting right now inside the Democratic Party and run in the caucuses in Iowa and in New Hampshire. For a lot of people, 16 presidential elections are around the corner, but for some of us, they're here. The reality is activists in Iowa and New Hampshire are mobilizing, and we need a strong voice. So what we need to do is, first of all, convince Bernie that there's an audience and we want him to run inside the Democratic primary. He's asked us to comment. John Nichols from The Nation magazine just ran a recent article, encouraged listeners to get a hold of that. He's asking for our comments, and that's what we're up to. Tom just sent out his letter. You signed one of the letters. Laura Flanders will be signing another one. I got mine out. We're a little over 4,000 some odd signatures as we speak today. So I hope your listeners will go to the
telling
website.
Bernie to run as a Democrat in the Democratic primary. It would be amazing to see Bernie in a primary debate with Obama and anybody else who decides to run.
PDAmerica.org, right corner, click on sign on. We need everybody's signature and send Bernie that message.
There you go. PDAmerica for progressive.org.
PDAmerica.org.
for the Progressive Democrats.
And it's in the right-hand corner. It says, sign here. Let's get Bernie to run as a Democrat.
Cool. Okay. Do it. Go to pdamerica.org and click on that. So you guys had your Progressive Roundtable this morning here in Washington, D.C. What happened?
Standing room only. If I had told you back in December that we would have a budget that the Progressive Caucus would put forward that would talk about financial transaction tax. We've got the Robinhood tax in there. We've got the carbon tax in there. So no longer do we have to talk about austerity. We can talk about prosperity. We have a revenue stream now to fund those projects we so desperately need to. We have a budget on the table that will roll back sequester. We have a budget now that's going to work to cut the military budget over $800 billion over the next 10 years. We're very excited. Now, do we have the votes to pass it this time? Probably not. But hopefully we have enough votes to send a clear message to not only the Progressive Caucus members, but to the Democratic majority, hopefully, when they come back, when we take back the House, that we have the blueprint to begin moving in a real progressive direction.
And to start making some serious noise about this. I mean, Paul Ryan throws out a budget, which is total nonsense, doesn't even make sense, and has not a snowball's chance in hell of passing, which is what they would say of the progressive budget, by the way. You know, it's not going to, the Republicans in the House are not going to bring it to a vote, just like the Democrats in the Senate aren't going to bring Paul Ryan's budget to the vote. And Paul Ryan is nationwide. He's on all the TV shows. He's everywhere. Everybody's talking about it. The Progressive Caucus in Congress, I think, has a larger constituency than Paul Ryan does, even in the House of Representatives. And it's like radio silence in the mainstream media. What the hell's going on here, Tim?
Well, things actually are a little bit better this cycle. Last year, we made a little bit of a breakthrough. Even President Clinton talked about the progressive budget. While we're realistic in not passing this budget, what we have is a real organizing tool. And we are starting to break through some of the media. The rollout's begun. We're here today with you, certainly. Mm-hmm. We would expect to be. But a mainstream media, it's beginning. And that's what this next month is about, is to make sure people are aware that there is a debate going on. And as you said, the 72 members of the Progressive Caucus, who make up the largest caucus, have real numbers that add up, have a real program that will put people back to work, and have a program that will deal with the deficit. So we can do all those things. But as you said, what we're lacking is that debate and the will to move forward.
Do you think the fact that this debate, or that this budget, rather, is different from the one that the president has proposed, which is the official Democratic Party's budget, presumably because the president's the head of the party, that has something to do with why it's not as loudly trumpet? I mean, the Republicans don't have a John Boehner budget and a Paul Ryan budget. They've got just the Paul Ryan budget.
No, we're the minority within the minority. We're the progressive in the progressive wing of the Progressive Party. We're the minority. We've got to buck that mainstream. But the party leadership is allowing us to move forward more than we did, more aggressively than we did 2 years ago, last year, and certainly this year. The amount of attention that the budget's already gotten, you've had, I believe, already Keith Ellison and Mark Pocan already on your station. The leadership understands we're getting organized. We're the first budget out. We've got real numbers. As I said today, Congress isn't even in session right now. They're back in their district offices where we're delivering letters. Over 300 letters will be delivered again this week in support of this budget. So we're demonstrating to the leadership of the Democratic Party that there's genuine grassroots support here. We deserve a debate. We want a debate. And we're going to have that debate. We're going to keep pushing over the course of the next couple of weeks to ensure that the leadership understands that.
And if you want to participate in that, you can go to pdamerica.org and sign up and become a member and say, hey, you know, I'll do this out of my kitchen table.
Absolutely. What you can do is download a letter in support of what's being called the Better Off Budget. That letter is a very simple letter that can be downloaded, and Connor or Mike Fox from our office will make sure you can hand deliver these to your member of Congress to let them know. This is the debate, as we said, that's going to go on now for the next couple of weeks, so there's plenty of time for everybody to get involved.
There you go. We're talking with Tim Carpenter. He's the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, where you can sign the petition to Bernie Sanders to please run as a Democrat.
Run, Bernie, run as a Democrat.
Yeah. And also you can read about the Better Off Budget. Give us some of the, you mentioned the carbon tax and the STET tax, the securities transaction tax, the Robinhood tax. What are some of the other pieces of the Better Off Budget, that the Progressive Caucus's budget, that Americans should know about? First of all, is it a balanced budget?
Yeah, they definitely, it's to work towards a balanced budget to bring down the deficit. In itself, it won't get us there, but it'll move us in with deficit reduction. I think with what little time we have, Tom, this morning to share with listeners, I think personally, after being with you for so many visits, is the single-payer movement. Bernie Sanders has now introduced his single-payer bill on the Senate side. We had our first hearing, and the Better Off Budget has that language in it to allow states to move forward with their plans to get the waiver restrictions lifted that they need in order to move towards single-payer.
So Vermont can go to single-payer immediately rather than waiting until after 2016.
Faster than they can. California, which is in the process. So that language is in is in the Better Off budget, which I'm personally very excited about. And as I said, on the heels of our first hearing in the Senate, a lot of momentum. I think on the defense side, to talk for the first time in real numbers, real reduction of $800 billion over the next 10 years, the military budget. What we're discovering going through this budget process are the real numbers in the Pentagon. The $480 billion that the president is asking for is not really the real number. There's a lot more going on there than meets the eye in this
budget.
You're
talking about the black numbers, the missing numbers, the vanished,
the slush fund,
yeah.
The numbers we don't hear about, the $50 billion stashed here and there,
right,
that we don't know about. So this is an attempt to put some light on that and to really cut the defense budget over the course of the next 10 years to put us on track to get the defense budget, the military budget back in order. And as I said, for those of us that have been really, really struggling with the Robin Hood tax and to get a fair debate on that, to have that in there. And then on April 4th, one thing to leave on the Robin Hood tax will be National Days of Action. We want to take each week as we move into the budget process to really focus on these issues. April 4th, unfortunately, marks the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. So on that day, we're going to really talk about what it means to have real revenue streams inside our budget where we can begin to do those things that Dr. King talked so much about, whether it be a jobs program or health care for all.
What does the Better Off budget do for people who have lost their homes as a result of the theft of $8 or $9 trillion by the banksters and who are long-term unemployed and have been cut off by the Republicans?
It puts the insurance. There's a number of things that are important in regards to sequester. First is the sequester. It rolls back the sequester numbers. It puts back the money that the unemployed that have been denied. It gives them back that. And then long term, I can't answer the specificity in regards to the banking reform, but it begins to look at the Dodd legislation and glass ceiling once again to get that back under control. But
to bring Glass-Steagall back into play.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a big deal. You know, it's like getting.
I think we can point to where a lot of it under the Clinton administration, where a lot of this unraveling began.
Well, and don't blame Bill Clinton. Blame Phil Graham and his wife, Wendy, who was on the board of Enron. I mean, this was all done because Ken Lay wanted it done.
And if we have enough time, we can go all the way back to Ronald Reagan when the rollback began.
Of course.
In real terms.
It all began with Reagan. That's what my wife says it's going to say on my tombstone. Tim Carpenter, PDAmerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, as always, Tom.
And get you over to PDAmerica.org and sign that petition to get Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
PDAmerica.org. Check it out. Okay. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. James in Spring City, Tennessee. You have a theory on the Malaysian Airlines. Hey, James, what's that?
Well, Tom, first off, I'd like to apologize for not being awake and doing my part. But I concur with what you were leading on as far as the theory on this Malaysian aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Downing, and as I understand, you made mention that they basically hired a hatchet man to run their airlines.
Right.
Something you might want to think about also is the insurance that this disappearance will generate when they finally get to make a claim. And basically, if you're talking about an airline that's struggling, this would be a great shot in the arm right there.
No, this is a lousy way to make money for an airline that's struggling because it's going to scare people away from flying the airline. So what little revenue they're making, they're losing.
Yes, I understand that. But then again, I mean, I agree with you. Do you think about the screwy heads that are basically taking care of business in this world?
Yeah.
Think about the way they're screwed on. I tried to make a phone call earlier this year to you, but basically my input is this. They're committing suicide, and I don't want them to take me with them or my children.
They being who?
Energy groups, corporations, banks.
Yeah.
I mean, just irresponsible with the way they're dealing with things.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, and we need to do something about that. I think the beginning point of that is to amend the Constitution to say that money is not speech, not protected by the First Amendment. So we can do something about, you know, basically billionaires running lies as ads and owning giant corporations, owning radio and television networks. It's a problem. Thanks a lot for the call. Charles in Miami. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
I record your show, so I always watch it in little bits. Yesterday, I watched the Guy McPherson section, and I thought, boy, talk about
putting the fear into our hearts.
Yeah.
And I understand there's certainly that potential, but one of the things I don't think we talk about, and I think we should, is human consciousness, where it is and where it's going, and how is it going to evolve. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was thinking is a possibility is, you know how we have our own subconscious minds, and if you observe yourself and if your listeners observe themselves, you'll see from time to time how your subconscious mind does something, and you end up doing it, and like you didn't even really want to do it. It's something you didn't think about doing, and you just end up doing it because, you know, there's another portion of our mind at work. And perhaps this is our collective subconscious working to move us to sort of a kick in the pants. Wake up, you're about to destroy, you know, your existence.
Right.
And move us to another state of consciousness, another state of mind. Now, you know, there's mystical states of consciousness, and history is replete with examples of human beings who have arrived at mystical states of consciousness, which are, you can't really describe what they are. You can read about them, and you say, wow, there's a state that human beings can get to, but it's very difficult. And it's obviously a state of great, you know, happiness and joy and fulfillment. But there are other states of consciousness, states of mind, and perhaps this is an attempt by ourselves, you know, creating this kick in the pants.
To wake ourselves up. I think you may be right, Charles. Thanks for the call. It's the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. We've had an interesting day here. We had a debate with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute about whether liberals hate humans. No, seriously. He wrote a book called The War on Humans. Liberals are trying to destroy humans. I don't think so. But I do think that liberals recognize the damage that humans are doing to the planet and would like us to, like, be more rational, and conservatives don't. And I went off seriously on Abby Huntsman and her quest to destroy Social Security as a useful idiot for Pete Peterson and the billionaires who want Wall Street to take all that money. And people don't even bother to do their damn homework to understand, you know, what the real condition of Social Security is, why the Social Security Trust Fund was even put there. It's really sad. Anyhow, John in Fresno, Cal. Oh, and I offered a couple of possibilities on the airline. One being, if it was pilot suicide, could it have been provoked by this pilot having been laid off or fired because the airline had just hired basically a hatchet guy to run the airline and cut costs? Or more likely, could it be that there was a fire in the cockpit and the pilot was a real hero, was doing everything he could to stop it, and he got overcome. Everybody died, you know, from the fire. Who knows? John, you have a theory about the plane?
Well, it's more of a question than a theory. With all the babbling that's been going on, and like CNN saying the same thing over and over and over again, one possibility that I haven't heard mentioned is it beyond the realm of possibility that there was a stowaway in the electronics bay under the cockpit who was monkeying around with things and went about this pretty much undetected until the plane was off course, and then
I think that's pretty unlikely. I mean, what would his motivation be?
Well, I don't know. What would be the motivation of any hijacker? Or he maybe just wanted to...
But see, a hijacker wants to get an airplane to a specific place for a specific reason. You can't do that if you're in the hold.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether they have control over any of the flight computers from down there.
I don't think so. I think it's all, you know, I think it's entirely okay. Just, you know, circuit breakers.
Okay. Anyway, just asking, I don't know.
Yeah. It's a theory. It's a theory. We can't discount anything right now. Who knows? John, thank you for the call. Betty in Albuquerque. Hey, Betty, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Tom, the very best to you and your loved ones. You are my role model and an icon.
Well, thank you.
Sir, I wanted to backtrack to your remarks about truth conveyance earlier, and its dissipation, if not outright annihilation. I can remember all too well back in the 80s when my youngest sister was coming home from college classes. She was studying to become an educator. And there were two new schools of thought introduced into college curriculums, especially for people studying for that. I can remember her coming home and saying right off the bat that the first thing she'd learned was A, number one was to give self-esteem to students.
Right.
And I said to her, well, that's crazy. That's something you work and you earn. And she said, oh, no, that's not what we're taught. It's imperative that that's what we give them first of all. Now, just in the past couple of years, and you can probably look this up, John Roseman, the syndicated columnist, child psychologist, lamented this in one of his columns the past couple of years.
Yeah, the whole every child's a winner thing.
Things.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Every child's a winner.
Right, exactly. A by honor student is this. And then the second school of thought, and this was, in my mind, the worst, was that all opinions are valid. The heck with the facts. I can remember saying to her, are you going to sit with a group of
flat earthers.
I can't remember what it was I used as an analogy. Yeah. But you're just going to sit with anybody at the dinner table and just welcome all opinions? And she said, this is what we're taught. Well, I told you, as I told your screener, I can remember when Susan Sontag, shortly before her death, her untimely death, Charlie Rose had her on an interview. And this was a hot topic during this time. He said, do you subscribe to this notion that all opinions are valid? And she threw her head back and uttered this throaty laugh, and she said, of course not, especially when they're stupid. Well, this is another thing that we have a nation of citizens walking around loaded with opinions, but it doesn't matter whether they're facts or not to back anything up.
Yeah. Yeah. And a surprising number of them can be found on the AM dial on talk radio. Betty, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 1350 there in Albuquerque. Tim in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tim. Social Security?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Okay. I love your show, and calling you is almost as bad as trying to get a hold of AT&T. No offense, but...
It's okay.
The biggest problem I have, and I have not heard it mentioned on your show, is that, you know, the way that the algorithms work for Medicaid, Medicare, SSI, all the above, a person who pays, let's say that minimum wage workers are earning, I don't know, around $13,000 to $15,000 a year.
Right.
By the time they turn 66, and of course, if they raise that, of course, that would be totally skewed. They would never be able to take that money back. What happens with the additional incomes? What I'm worried about. But also, more importantly, disabled kids that are born into this world totally and permanently disabled, their status is never going to change. You know, kids with CP and spina bifida, stuff like that, are presumably not going to get a whole lot better than whatever the treatments allow. We doom these kids when they become adults to earn three-quarters of what the minimum wage worker earns. I mean, they cannot get more than $744 per month, which is what the maximum allowable benefit on SSI is.
Yeah. I had a niece with spina bifida. She was 20 years old and was just beginning to acquire language skills. I don't understand your point.
My point is that they should not be grouped together. There should be a total different class set up for the disabled. Social Security income was set aside.
Well, SSI is for disabled
people. But it doesn't work that way, because if you take a worker that has worked, say, 20 years and gets a bad back and goes on SSI, they are allowed to make upwards of $2,500 a month. SSI, you know, when somebody never has that chance to work, or acquire more of an income, and they're
Tim, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If your bottom line was you want to tinker around the edges with Social Security and SSI, you know, fine, good luck with that. First, let's get the conservatives to stop trying to throw it all at Wall Street. Okay, here we go. First of all, this article, I don't see where it came from. There's no line on it, but the photos are by Bite Girls Flickr. Over the weekend, a couple of peculiar-looking pigeons were spotted near Five Points on Jackson Avenue in Long Island City, and they've got pictures. And these pigeons look like they were parrots that had been painted over to look like pigeons from about two-thirds of the way up, which, of course, is probably what happened, because everybody knows that real pigeons don't exist. They're all robots, and the planet Xenu sent here to spy on us. which leads to the note I got from Howard, who says, here's the real reason for the disappearing plane. It's the mothership from the planet Xenu. There was a pigeon expert on board the Malaysian Airlines, and in order to keep him from talking, a Close Encounters of the Third Kind abduction of the entire plane happened. Watch for an increased pigeon agitation to begin shortly. Apparently, it's already started in Long Island. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. I'm more and more, I'm thinking that this smoke in the cockpit, you know, noxious fumes killing everybody in the plane is really starting to look like a very, very logical, very straightforward answer. Occam's razor and all that. Ted in Chicago. Hey, Ted.
Hey, I'm very happy to be on the phone with you.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say I tuned in when the gentleman that talked so fast.
Tim Carpenter.
Yeah, out on point for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And I wanted to let you know that I want the peace for the Chicago suburban area, and I'd be very glad to go out on point. I did that yesterday. I worked 30 days to get my friends elected. Mm-hmm. Got lucky in the raffle on 2 out of 4.
That's great.
And I think if we just keep marching like that across the country, we could put the whole wheel back together and make some movement.
Yeah, well, call Bernie back and tell him he should run in the Democratic primary on Friday. You know, he'll be on the radio here.
Last year I had an intern program. I made people listen to Stephanie Miller in the morning, you in the afternoon, and Norman Goldman at night. It was 30 days long, progressive radio, 820 out of Chicago.
Right.
And at the end of 30 days, I would let them stay with me or find them a state job.
Yeah. That's great.
And 18 years with the General Assembly in Illinois, mm-hmm. 75 through 92. And the way it is now isn't anything close to when I was there.
Yeah.
No. So it's really got to be taken apart and put back together.
It really does. The Supreme Court has done so much damage to this country by asserting that money is protected by the First Amendment and that corporations
That's
are protected
the
by the 14th
one.
Amendment. It's a terrible, terrible
There's
thing.
There's one way to take money out of politics, and that is to say we will allow a candidate to raise and or spend 1% as an example of the vote count in the last general election.
Yeah.
And if they exceed that, raising money or spending money, anything over that is their penalty that goes in the general fund.
Yeah, here's the problem, Ted. According to the Supreme Court, you cannot legislate the use of money in the political arena because they say that the founders wrote money into the First Amendment and therefore it's protected. I disagree with that. I think it's wrong. I think we need a constitutional amendment to change it. It's why I say, you know, we need to go for movetoamend.org, but that's it. Charles in Cleveland, Texas. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm just curious.
Charles?
Yes.
In Texas, you're on the air.
Hear me now?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I was wondering, I'm going to retire soon, and I was looking into Social Security,
mm-hmm.
and it seems you get an increase from the age of 66 to 70 if you work till you're 70. When did they change that the maximum benefit wasn't the age of retirement?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I know that it's been done. And it's encouraging people to work longer and longer, which I think is a bad thing. It's keeping people in the workforce so that jobs are not available for young people. If anything, what we should be doing is we should be lowering the retirement age for Social Security down to 60, and we should make at the age of 65 giving people full benefits and full eligibility. You can actually retire at 63, but the benefits are, you know, for the rest of your life are so much lower that it's for
that.
Most people it's like not worth the trouble. But frankly, I got to say, Charles, I didn't even know that from 65 to 70, if you postponed your retirement, you got more and more money. That's grim news. And I don't know when it happened. I'll see if I can track it down. And when I do find it, I'll report back here. Robert in Downey, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
You want to talk about the TPP?
Yeah.
SHAFTA.
How can that get passed in a lame duck Congress when The corporations are going to spend a lot of free speech on the losers and for a nice retirement program, and it's going to take us 10 years. And then, wait a second. And then what happens is this takes out the Constitution, basically, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Fast track is, in my opinion, unconstitutional, in the opinion of a lot of people in the political and legal realm. And because what it does is it abrogates the Constitution. It says you no longer have the ability to debate or amend legislation, and you no longer have the ability to operate by the House or Senate rules. It is simply subject to an up or down vote without amendment, and it exaggerates the power of the executive branch and diminishes the power of the legislative branch, which is exactly what the founders were afraid of. So, yeah, this is... Excuse me.
With move to amend last week, it was said that it's going to take 10 years to get rid of that bad decision.
I think that's the most pessimistic number. David Cobb is putting that out not to get people's expectations too high, but we do need. Historically, what you find is that when you get a consensus among about 20% of the population on a very detailed and specific thing, like we should pass a constitutional amendment declaring two things. One, money is not speech. Two, corporations, for-profit and non-profit, corporations are not people. When you get a solid 20%, then it happens. And we're at probably 2 or 3 or 4% right now. So we've got a lot of educating to do, a lot of organizing to do, and that's why it's so important to go over to movetoamend.org and sign up and start a group, start a local chapter in your kitchen, in your bedroom, in your living room, wherever it may be that you're sitting there with your computer most of the time. Make it happen. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Jerry, listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks very much. You were talking with your guest, Tim Carpenter, about Bernie Sanders running for president as a Democrat. And in my opinion, I think it's a terrible idea, and I think it would be a major political mistake and miscalculation for one of Social Security's best and strongest real defenders, Bernie Sanders, to run for president as a Democrat, because both the corporate special interests and the Democratic establishment, they're likely to strongly mobilize to prevent him from actually winning the nomination and wrestling it away from, say, Hillary Clinton. And then when he loses the nomination, he's going to be pressured by the Democratic leaders to drop out of the presidential race altogether and to be a loyal Democrat and to support the Democratic nominee, even if that Democratic nominee is not progressive enough.
Yeah, I would suggest, Jerry, that the way it would play out is, A, what he would do, in effect, is he would play the role that Ted Kennedy did. And now I realize there are some pundits who think or who assert that Jimmy Carter lost the election in 1980 because Ted Kennedy challenged him. But what Ted Kennedy did was he moved Carter to the left in a whole lot of directions, in a whole lot of issues, and it was a good thing. And Carter didn't lose that election because he was challenged by Kennedy. Carter lost that election because Bill Casey, who ran the Reagan campaign, got the Iranians to hold the hostages until after the election.
But, Tom, don't you think that could be better accomplished by Elizabeth Warren running against Hillary Clinton, and then you have Bernie Sanders could still run as an independent?
That's a possibility too. I think though that independents have a history of shooting themselves in the foot or shooting the Democratic Party in the foot. I'd rather see the Democratic Party be taken over by progressives like Bernie or Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Bernie's very clear that he doesn't want to be. He's as he said on this program several times. I don't wake up every morning wanting to be president. There are people in Washington D.C. who do. We know who their names are. Bernie's not one of them. But he said if no other progressive steps forward and starts aggressively asserting that there are things that need to be done, then he will get in to push the party to the left. Now, I think, frankly, if Elizabeth Warren does, probably Bernie won't. But time will tell. Right. We'll see. Jerry, I respectfully disagree with you, though. Robert in Ontario, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First time, long time. About Bernie Sanders running for president, What do you think his position on campaign finance reform, or I guess more specific to the point, how would he raise money being a critic of campaign finance reform?
Well, he is in favor of campaign finance reform. He's in favor of publicly funded campaigns. And, I think, frankly, that he would probably be looking to individual donations. I don't think that he would succeed. I don't think that there is a probability that Bernie could wrestle the nomination away from a mainstream Dem. But what Bernie right. could do is he could inject into the Democratic Party's debate those yeah. issues which are important to progressives, which are by and large ignored by the mainstream Democratic Party. And that's, I think, a really important role. Robert, thanks for listening to AM760's Webstream. We'll be back. It's quarter to 15 minutes before the hour. And we'll be back with more. Your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day, and all that cool stuff. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. And you can drop by our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's free. It's fun. And welcome back. Bill in Sequim, Washington? Sequim?
No, it's Squim, Washington.
Squam. Okay. So Squim. What's up? Squim.
Squim,
okay.
S-Q-U-I-M.
Okay, so what's up?
Well, I have a good plan for the Democrats to win
okay.
The election this cycle and forever on. The American people have a very short memory span, so if they're given a history lesson on Republican presidents since Hoover, on every one of them, from Hoover to Eisenhower to Nixon to Reagan to Bush Sr. to Bush Jr., and their track record, what they've done to the economy of this country, every time they get their hands on it, they've destroyed it.
You're right.
So if you want to go back to the way these guys do it all the time, put the country in a hole like Bush Jr., our latest one, then vote for them.
Yeah. And
the Republican Party. And then otherwise, keep your head above the ground, you know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I wish the Democrats would you know, get a little... grow a spine and start speaking like that. Bill, thanks for the call. We need more Harry Truman in the Democratic Party. Charlotte in Somerville, South Carolina. Hey, Charlotte, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hey, Tom. Mr. Smith made me so mad. For one thing, a grid is the most vulnerable way. Rooftop solar is the way to go. And the other thing he's talking about, you know, taking us out of whatever we're in, we're almost out of antibiotics. The bacteria are going to get us before anything else.
Right.
Even ourselves.
Right. So, and, so you're the Mr. Smith you're talking about.
He's a fool.
Did
that's all.
Yeah. Okay. What are you talking about? Our guest.
Yeah.
Wesley Smith.
Yeah.
Oh, so he was. But what he was arguing was that, or what he was trying to assert, is that liberals hate humans. I mean, that's his message to boil it down. And I'm trying to say, where do you get that from? I mean, you know, liberals want to have national health care. I don't understand.
Yeah. Humans are fine. Humans are fine. We're still going to be outlived by the rats and cockroaches.
Yeah.
And that's pretty obvious. So, but he was going on about an electrical grid across Africa, and that is the most vulnerable way to supply electricity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that was the point that I was making, is instead of building an electrical grid with giant power stations, which the conservatives all love because the giant corporations do it, why not put solar panels on the roof of every house and leapfrog people literally from the 17th century right into the 21st century without going through the coal and fossil fuels of the 19th and 20th centuries?
We should be doing that here.
Yes, we should. Germany's doing it. But Denmark's doing it. China's doing it.
At any rate. The other thing about that plane is I read something on HuffPost last night that they may have, programmed their Plan D into the autopilot because they couldn't return to Kuala Lumpur because it would have meant crossing a mountain range.
That's correct. And what they had programmed it for was a little island that had an 11,000-foot airstrip, which that plane could have landed on. It only needs 5,000 feet. And I think the pilot was heading for that. I think he was overcome by smoke, and I think that everybody was probably dead on that plane, and then it just flew until it ran out of fuel. But time will tell. I mean, that's a good theory. Charlotte, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Come on. 6:24. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Diane in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, listening to WCPT. You have a theory on the Malaysian airline?
I have a theory, yes. I think that the Malaysian government sabotaged the plane because the pilot went to the trial for his friend, whose charges were acquitted, and then they reinstated them. And they were afraid he was going to be part of the opposition, because that's a dictatorship. And who knows what other opposition members were on the plane. No one's talked about it.
Yeah. There was an article on March 8th. This is before the plane went missing in the Financial Times. The headline, it's by Jeremy Grant in Singapore. The headline was Malaysia Airlines Battles Against Low-Cost Carriers. And they write, in spite of carrying almost two-thirds more passengers last year compared to 2012, Malaysia Airlines made a loss in the full year 2013 of $522 million. That was worse than the previous year and piles pressure on Mr. Yaha, known as the industry as AJ, to achieve results from a two-year turnaround program. And, they're under more pressure than most of their peers in the region since Southeast Asia's largest low-cost carrier Air Asia was established in Malaysia and is listed on the Kuala Lumpur Stock Exchange. And so, you know, whether that had something to do with it, maybe even just bad maintenance. I mean, you know, using tires longer than they should be using them and or not checking the inflation of them so that a tire that was on fire got pulled up into the wheel well in the nose of the plane, which increasingly to me makes the most sense. I don't know, Diane. I just don't know. Thank you for the call, though. Ken in Lebanon, Missouri. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your show.
Thanks.
My suggestion, and I love Bernie Sanders, and I do believe he would make a great president. Anyway, his best weapon right now against Hillary Clinton is the fact that Bill Clinton is the guy that freed up the banks to rip off America. And I know the Republicans are going to use that against her, and he may not even have to pull it out of his bag of tricks. Okay. But I really think she wouldn't have a chance once the American people say, hey, Bill Clinton, you gave the banks the right to take my home.
But see, it wasn't Bill. It was Congress. I mean, yes, Bill Clinton signed the legislation, but it was really Ken Lay driving that train and Phil Gramm doing his bidding with both Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. This all happened a year or so before Enron went down in flames. And I don't think you can blame that on Hillary. And I don't think the Republicans are going to mention it because they're in bed with the banksters, too. And they don't want the dialogue out in the public that the banksters were responsible for the crash. They've been running around yelling that Jimmy Carter was responsible for the crash. And I mean, you know, watch Fox News. I mean, you might be right, Ken. We'll see. But I'm skeptical of it. Thank you for the call, though. Virginia in Churchville, Maryland. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hi, my head is exploding. Do you know who Paul Farmer is?
Name sounds familiar, but it doesn't come to mind.
He's an MD, a doctor that graduated from Harvard, and he does work all over the world. He has three solar hospitals that he just opened. Two are in Africa, and one is in Haiti.
Uh-huh. Good on him. So why don't we do this with every hospital?
Why don't we do this? If Germany can have 30 or 40% of their energy solar, we could do that all over the world. It's cold in Germany. I live there.
Yeah, it's not only cold. It's the cloudiest country in the entire European continent. And I live there, too. And I'm with you, Virginia. I'm absolutely with you. Thanks for bringing up Paul Farmer and give everybody a chance to go looking off on that. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, you wanted to talk about Wesley and human exceptionalism?
Yeah. He brought up the point that technology would take care of everything, and that he wanted people to be more prosperous. Well, you know, I think technology got us into a lot of the problems we're in. I think it is going to be some of the solutions, but I think we consume too much. We consume on a want basis more than a need basis, and especially the United States consumes way too much, far more than the rest of the world.
Yeah, we're 4% of the world's population. We consume 25% of the world's resources. I'm absolutely with you. We need to downsize our footprint, particularly with regard to fossil fuels. Thank you, Dave. Good one. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean, you wanted to talk about SSI. You are living on SSI, are you not?
Well, yes, I am. And it's really frustrating not being able to work. You know, I don't have any hands, but I can still work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very frustrating. And even more frustrating is when conservatives say that people like me are draining the economy.
Right.
I support the pharmaceutical industry and my nurse, my aide, my homemaker, and just the general consumer. If anything, we contribute to...
You're a job creator, Sean.
We really are.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating hearing conservatives say that.
Yeah.
All we want is a chance.
Yeah.
You know, every job that I have ever had, I have been fantastic with, because, you know, you don't take that stuff for granted.
Yep. Yep.
So, Tom, one more thing. If you saw 60 Minutes last week, they were talking about drones the size of dragonflies.
Oh, my.
And your pigeon thing may not be as far off as you think.
Yeah, I believe it, Sean. In fact, I know it to be the case. And between that and the fact that apparently they can flip your phone on anytime they want and take pictures of you and listen to what's going on in the room, I mean, it's getting pretty weird. Sean, thanks a lot for the call. And Armin, you already called in this week. Only Louise was answering the phone instead of Danielle. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the latest news and information that you won't be hearing from the corporate-owned media. Plus, we'll be talking the issues of the day with attorney Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, and my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science, together with your calls, as always. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does begin with you. Get over to Progressive Democrats of America website, pdamerica.org. Sign the Bernie petition. Get active. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.